This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I have my own misgivings of spending that amount of money trying to deter migrants from coming across. Yeah, when we're underfunding hospitals, the health service, you can't get a dentist, the schools are falling to pieces, the roads are a complete and utter nightmare, potholes everywhere. You know, it's all about a balancing act.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week that thousands of homes were given a nod in Maidstone, plans to tackle poor health in Medway and Swale were announced, and we visited Sittingbourne to see why it's grown to a standstill. I'm Simon Finley, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by Daniel Essen, who reports on borough and district councils in Kent.
Hello, hello.
And news editor Sean Delaney, who is standing in for Medway Council reporter Robert Boddy, who's away this week.
Hello.
And we'll also be speaking to KM political editor Paul Francis about the week in Westminster. And our special guest this week is Dover District Council leader Kevin Mills. First up, Dan, what's been happening with you then?
So yet again, I've been up to my eyes in local planning, but this time right in the heart of the county in Maidstone, because last week Maidstone Borough Council passed its plan for house building for the period up to 2038 in the face of some pretty stiff opposition.
So what were the highlights?
So basically, over the 17 years of the plan, it allocates spaces for over 17,000 homes to be built in the borough, which works out to just over 1,000 a year. That's made up by lots of sort of piecemeal proposals here and there, but the real points of contention are the really big developments. So there's the Invicta Barracks in Maidstone, which is earmarked for just over 1,000 homes and has been for a little while now, currently occupied by the army, but set to be vacant by about 2027. There's also, you know, two even bigger ones. There's one which riled up a lot of opposition is for what they call a garden settlement at Lidsing. Currently, you know, Lidsing's a minuscule little hamlet by the near the border with Medway. But under the council's local plan, which was passed, that'll grow to be an urban extension of 2,000 homes. And then there's another even larger garden settlement proposed near Lenham and Lenham Heath, which is slated to be an entire new village of 5,000 new homes.
OK. There was a protest at the meeting about these plans. So what were they saying? What were the objectors got to say for themselves?
So there are two separate campaign groups against both of those, you know, really large rural developments. But essentially, they were making very similar points. They were saying that you know, the infrastructure can't cope, the impact on traffic, you know, which is already terrible, will be completely intolerable. And all of them stressed to me that Maidstone Borough Council, over the past 10 years in particular, has already delivered huge amounts of homes. So essentially, they were saying that, you know, precious green land in an increasingly urbanised borough will be lost to all of these proposals. And some of them even said to me that the solution is to simply make the county town itself bigger, to build more in Maidstone, make it bigger and more dense, rather than building on the countryside.
Well, the actual councillors themselves, what was the debate like?
So it wasn't quite as arduous as it could have been, given how controversial the plan was. It was only about 2.5 hours of debate. You know, councils have to have local plans, so there weren't really any attempts to, you know, straight up refuse it and stop the plan in its tracks. But there were a couple of abortive attempts to delay it. The leader of the Green Group first gave go. He proposed an amendment trying to delay it until after the election on May 2nd, when the whole council was up for election. But that was defeated, as people said, well, it's taken us years to come up with this local plan. It'll probably cause complete chaos if we, you know, expect some people who've just been elected to make decisions on it. So that was defeated. And then there was another amendment attempting to delay it for a more modest attempt at only about 2 weeks, to respond to some concerns raised about the plans by the county council. But that was also defeated. The Tory leadership of the council argued their case pretty strongly, and that they stressed that they pretty much said they had to approve it then and there. They say the evidence used to assess the borough's housing needs, on which the local plan is based, would expire on 30th of March. And from that point on, they would be forced to, you know, either recalculate their housing targets, meaning probably accept more homes, and it would leave them open to what they call speculative development. Basically, developers coming in and they get an easier time of it at planning committee when the council doesn't have a local plan. But, you know, after all that debate and the sort of failed attempts to delay it further, the council did end up voting in favour of it. So the local plan for Maidstone Borough Council up to 2038 has officially been passed. passed. So in theory, that means planning applications could start coming in for these new settlements and big developments pretty soon.
Okay, very interesting. I understand that we only went through with the help of some of the independents, the Tory group and the independents. Everybody else voted against it. But
It was quite a slim margin.
I don't think the opposition parties were very happy about it indeed. But look, thanks very much indeed, Dan. Right, Sean, you've been tracking the goings-on in Medway. What's caught your eye this week?
Yeah, so something called the Medway and Swell Social Regeneration Scheme, which was launched at a big conference, which brought together basically all the big wigs from volunteering, social care, healthcare, housing, education and industry sectors.
And what's the aim of this scheme?
In basic terms, it wants to bring together all of the different sectors mentioned in an effort to raise the living standards and health of residents across that part of North Kent.
Yeah, so that's an interesting idea. Can you tell us a little bit more about how it works?
It is. So speakers highlighted that only 20% of a person's health is actually influenced by the healthcare they receive. The remaining 80% is down to factors like housing, diet, income and job status, community safety and education. The people behind the scheme aim to make the different sectors more efficient by working closer together. This also seeks to reduce the strain on the NHS by improving residents' general health earlier, so problems requiring medical attention don't develop further along the line.
Okay, so who was there and what did they have to say?
So speaking at the event, Ashley Hook, who is chief executive of social housing provider MHS Homes, said poor quality housing and the effect it has on people's health represents a 1.4 billion cost to the NHS every year. Similarly, Dr. Natalie Goldring, who heads up the public health intelligence team at Medway Council, presented data which showed how deprivation and other factors impact on life expectancy. A shocking fact was that within different wards in Medway, just miles apart, you see an average life expectancy difference of 10 years. The scheme obviously aims to tackle this, but it's not going to be an easy job.
That's a very interesting fact about health inequalities there. Look, it sounds like important work. Thanks, Sean.
So, Simon, what's been going on at Kent County Council recently?
I've spent the earlier part of this week looking at the situation facing people in Sittingbourne, where roadworks and housing developments have started to make life pretty intolerable for local people.
Is this new?
Well, it's not really new. The local council has to put in 15,000 homes through targets set by the central government, and there's the possibility of another 11,000 coming in on top of that, although the local council, Swaleborough Council, wants to try and get that reduced to around about 6. But now that the work has kind of started in earnest on all of these houses, there's other types of work going on for utility companies, pothole repairs and the like, and there are major works on the A249, there are developments on the A2, and it seems that a combination of all these factors have led to road closures or partial closures everywhere, and people are sometimes spending hours getting from A to B when A to B is not very far distance at all. And this has been going on for months, but it's lately has just got to the point where people are saying that they feel pretty fed up with it all.
So what specifically are people telling you about how this is affecting?
Well, there was one young woman I spoke to called Megan, and she moved 5 years ago from Bermondsey in South London for a quieter, better quality of life in Kent, or so she thought. And she said, and it was really telling, she said that she feels trapped in her home because the traffic sometimes doesn't move and she can't go anywhere. She has to leave 90 minutes for her to travel 15 miles in the morning to get to work. And there are many folk who just say they're avoiding, leaving the house, using the car. Others having to abandon their vehicles mid-journey to complete them on foot. People are missing appointments. People are not being able to get the kids to school, general inconvenience. And everyone blames the increase on the number of houses that are being built and everything that comes with it.
But obviously, one way or another, new houses need to be built. And when new houses get built, it involves a lot of roadworks. So what could actually be done to fix the traffic problems from that?
Well, in the longer term, there's been a lot of talk, apparently, about a bypass or a relief road for the north and the south of the Sittingbourne, but that's all it's really amounted to so far. It's just been talk. If it was to happen, most councillors of all political stripes say that it will bring another 10,000 houses and no one wants them either. So a bit of a catch-22. And in any case, the local independent councillor, Mike Baldock, basically sort of said, well, most people couldn't afford to live in the houses that are being built in any case. And he says that there should be a greater emphasis on affordable housing, council and social housing. Well, that wraps it up for what's been happening across Kent and Medway. Thanks to Dan and Sean for your insights.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we're speaking to Paul Francis, our political editor, about events in Westminster. What's been going on then, Paul?
Well, it's all about planes, trains and automobiles this week, with fears that Kent could be gridlocked and travellers facing long delays as the Great Easter Getaway gets underway. Because if you think that's bad enough, things might be even worse later on in the year with the introduction of new exit and entry systems for non-EU travellers. There's a bit of jargon there, but I'll get to that particular hornet's nest shortly. But first off, there's a familiar ring to complaints about emergency planners being too keen to press the button marked Operation Brock. But I'm detecting growing political anxieties about the fact that Op Brock seems to be triggered every time a school holiday beckons. We've spoken about this before, as you know, but another MP, Ashes Damien Green, is joining the ranks of those who say it clogs up the local roads unnecessarily. Now, KCC gets it in the neck, perhaps unfairly, as it has to deal with the consequences of disruption, and there's not many other options on the table.
Mm. You've been looking at other plans that could potentially mean even more disruption to the county. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is all about new arrangements coming in for what is dubbed the entry-exit system, not exactly the catchiest of titles, for people travelling from non-EU countries, that's the UK, into those that are still part of the EU. And you're going to need a whole bunch of different things.
So can you just sort of, in short, just explain how the EES is going to work?
Well, I could say there's nothing like a short version of it, but I'll try. Basically, these are the new arrangements which will substitute the traditional stamping of your passport. You're going to have to get biometric tests to show your identity. You're going to have to relay the dates on which you're travelling. You're going to have to produce ID. And there's a whole bunch of different things which are regarded as by the EU as necessary, particularly, they say, not in the interest of speeding up travel, but detecting fraud. And they don't go into detail what kind of fraud these checks will catch, but that's what they're arguing.
So if you turn up at Dover, what sort of thing will happen, and why are these delays likely to happen? Can you sort of...
Well, yeah, there's a bit of an information gap here, but basically the suggestion appears to be that there'll be kiosks littered around all the channel ports where you go and register your details and get your documents implemented or inserted. Now, that's what people are expecting, but there's no actual detail on what these kiosks will do, where they might be. There's a suggestion that there is an app in development to allow people to register some of their details before they set off on their journeys. But guess what? That app is not ready for use yet. So that is why both the leaders of Kent County Council and Ashford Council told MPs recently that at the onset of this new system, it could very quickly lead to queues of 14 to 15 hours while people waited to get their documents in place.
And Neil Baker, who's the sort of transport cabinet member at Kent County Council, he said that there's even the possibility of Operation Brock being in place permanently for about 3 years.
Yes, that's the doomsday scenario. It's kind of Armageddon meltdown, isn't it? But I think he's making a point here that outside Kent, people don't really appreciate the consequences of Operation Brock and these other plans that are coming in October. Because, you know, once the county is in kind of a semi-lockdown, if you like, tourist industry feels the consequences. You know, you spoke earlier about kids not being able to get to school, people not being able to make GP's appointments. There's a whole range of kind of micro-level activity, which if you don't live in Kent, you don't necessarily understand or appreciate.
All you'll see are the delays, whereas the A roads and the back roads will start seeing, you know, the usual sort of juggernauts travelling through your little villages, I suppose.
It's a bit like Operation Brock on steroids. No, we should just mention one possible uptick from all of this is the suggestion by the leader of Kent County Council that Eurostar trains might possibly resume stopping services at Ashford and Ebbsfleet to take some of the pressure off St Pancras, where travellers will similarly have to do all these registration of their details.
Wait, are you saying that if they introduce it there, then obviously they can capture the details of as many more passengers as they possibly can? Is that what you're saying?
If you're travelling on Eurostar, you'll have to do the same as everybody else in terms of your ID and your biometric details. So as if you've seen the queues at St Pancras recently, you'll appreciate just exactly what the consequences might be when October comes around. And I don't know whether this is getting any traction, but it's a novel idea from the leader of the Kent County Council to suggest maybe that they could spread the burden and do that by resuming stopping services at Ebbsfleet or Ashford.
Thank you, Paul, for your insight into what's happening. See you next week.
It's a pleasure. See you again.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast?
Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to Kent Politics Podcast at thekmgroup.co.uk.
Kevin Mills has been a mainstay of Kent political life for decades, and now he is leader of Dover District Council, and he joins me and Dan in the studio now. How are you doing, Kevin?
I'm doing fine, thanks very much.
Just talk us through your journey into politics. You've been a union official for as long as I can remember, and a Labour politician for as long as I can remember. Why did you get into that then?
Well, I suppose we've got a trade union history in my family, so I mean that was quite a normal move into. But I mean, I left school, went for the coal board, went to Betsanga Colliery, joined the NUM probably on day one, left there I left there on the 26th of February 1984, just before the dispute, and joined Customs and Excise as it was then, and again would have joined on day one. But I mean, to some extent, and my trade union beliefs led to the political, because it was put up or shut up. So, you know, I think it was a natural progression from being involved in the trade union movement at all levels through to then getting involved in politics in probably the mid-80s to getting elected in 1991. Same year as I got married.
So it's a long time in politics.
It is. It seems a long time in politics. It seems an extremely long time when you look at some of the older photographs of a younger Kevin Mills with a moustache and whatever, but such is life.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you, Kevin, is obviously the main thing people think of when they think of Dover is obviously the port. Like you said, you used to work in Customs Excise, what is now Border Force. So I imagine you've got pretty intimate knowledge of the workings of the port. Obviously something that's quite topical at the moment is the proposed entry and exit system for moving people in and out of the EU. You know, how do you think that's going to work out? Do you believe the sort of worst predictions of 14-hour delays are going to come true?
The issue at the moment is nobody knows, but you have to plan for the worst. I mean, I was with Doug Bannister last night. We had a public meeting in Snargate Street looking at EES and, again, the holiday traffic. It should come in about October the 4th, where everyone will have to go out, do a biometric testing. Hopefully it lasts 3 years, I believe, once it's been done. The difficulty is the delays. Now, everything we're being told is that we're all right as long as we're not dealing with more than about 415 cars an hour. So it's at peak times that it will get potentially really bad. That's where we're seeing possible delays of 14 hours. Now, fingers crossed, that may not happen till Easter 2025. So we have a bit of time to put stuff in. But, I mean, to some extent, this has been put back, four times. So it's, you know, everyone knew it was coming, and there was no point putting our heads in the sand and thinking it was never going to happen. So we need to prepare for it. The real difficulty that we have in Dover is, well, there's not enough land in the eastern docks to do it, because obviously you have to do it in your biometric tests, etc., to register in very close proximity to the PAF, the French authorities. And of course, what currently they're saying, and there may be some move, but this will need to be done at a much higher level in politics than I've ever achieved, that you can do it actually away from the port area. But it's a security issue. So the last thing anybody in Europe would want is to be tested 3 miles from the port, and then for somebody to, you know, get other people in the vehicle to abuse the system. So there's a bit of discussion going on at the moment, but it has all the potential to cause huge chaos in Kent. Now, I'm very pro-Kent. I'm more concerned about Dover going back to Folkestone. But, you know, it has the potential to cause massive problems in Kent if we don't get it right, because of the nature of our juxtaposed controls, where we do on the opposite sides of the channel to everywhere else. So, and I think there's only three places that do juxtaposed controls: Northern France, Dover for Calais, and St Pancras in London. So, you know, it has the ability to cause a lot of delays. But I'm hoping that we don't see the delays, because the Kent Resilience Task Force have looked to put some new plans in for this weekend. But, I mean, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating. I mean, we are all concerned in Dover, because it's not just the seafront. It's not just the fact that it causes lots of problems for those going on holiday. It literally closes Dover. Nothing moves around Dover. So there are, you know, a number of concerns on a normal holiday. If you add in then EES and the potential implications of that, you know, it could be a summer holiday on steroids. So we've got to do our utmost to mitigate against that. And I think actually it'll probably need some real radical decisions on how we keep the traffic of where Dover moving.
On a sort of similar topic, immigration, both, you know, legal and illegal, is obviously a huge issue in Dover, and has been for a better part of 30 years. You're party nationally says that if they get into government, they'll crack down on the small boats crisis. What are they going to do differently that hasn't been done before?
I mean, I think the view nationally on ours, I mean, obviously to start with, there's got to be much more international working on it. Is, I mean, they're focusing very much on the organised crime gang and stopping that side of it. I mean, the reality is everyone says, oh, it has a real impact on Dover, and I'm not playing it down because no one wants to see small boats for whatever reason, be it the health and safety, the immigration side or whatever. It's an exceptionally dangerous way to cross the channel. And it was, you know, my members that sadly were dragging the bodies out of the sea, not just in the channel, but obviously in the Aegean as well, is that the numbers, and I'm not playing it down, are relatively small. Mm-hmm. Something like 30,000 crossed the water in boats last year, at the same time that the government probably issued something like 1.4 million visas.
But it's not the numbers, it's the nature of those 30,000 people crossing. They're crossing very, very dangerous waters.
Oh, no, I fully agree. And that's why you say, whether you're pro or anti, no one wants to see small boats because of it's like walking blindfolded across the M25 in rush hour. I mean, it's lethal. And, when people say, do you think we'll see more fatalities? The reality is, we couldn't tell you, anybody could tell you how many have died in the channel because no one counts them out and no one counts them in. So, when we see deaths, which are horrible, we've seen far too many of those. You've got to be a certain type of post and not to feel moved by that. I mean, I understand, we had more children arrive Tuesday. We've now exceeded the numbers this year that we had last year. So all of the rhetoric around stopping the small boats seems to be failing. Something needs to be done. And I'm not going to underestimate the difficulty in dealing with organised crime gangs. Organised crime in smuggling, whatever the commodity, humans or drugs or alcohol, has been around since probably Napoleonic times, if not before. Mm-hmm. It is a real task.
What about the Rwanda plan? I mean, leaving the politics to the side,
yep.
Can that act as a deterrent?
I'm sure it will act as a deterrent to some. I'm not sure, looking at some of the figures, I mean, I think the Daily Telegraph ran an article at the beginning of the month reckoning it could cost, over a five-year period, something like £150,000 for every person we send to Rwanda. So, it's an exceptionally expensive system. It may work, but I sometimes wonder how much of it is sort of saber rattling and this is what we've got to do. I mean, it's going to be exceptionally expensive. I'm not sure Rwanda will actually take the numbers that we've seen up to now. Will it work? I mean, I think even Israel stopped it. I mean, I think they were sending some there once upon a time. So I have my own misgivings of spending that amount of money trying to deter migrants from coming across. When we're underfunding hospitals, the health service, you can't get a dentist, the schools are falling to pieces, the roads are a complete and utter nightmare, potholes everywhere. It's all about a balancing act. That will be for the incoming government, whoever they may be.
Yeah, a few weeks ago we had Nabi Elphick on, and she was talking about the small boats, the whole industry of making the boats and supplying the engines and the life jackets and all the rest of it. But more fundamentally, she was making the point that the whole nature of forced migration has changed because people aren't fleeing persecution or conflict anymore. They're fleeing climate change and famine, and that's not going to change anytime soon. So even if you were able to stop the boats, they would just find another way.
Well, they've always found another way. I mean, what happened was that the government gave lots of money to the French to secure Calais, because as you will remember and I remember, we had large numbers coming over in backs of lorries then. Mm-hmm. We had people running onto the trains at Eurotunnel and coming over. So you secure that element. So the next thing is you change your modus operandi. Mm. So then it went to small boats coming over. That doesn't mean that we're not still seeing people in backs of lorries, in aircrafts, in yachts, etc., coming over. But, I mean, it's not just about fleeing war or persecution because of your religion or your sexuality. As climate change grabs hold, we will end up with sections of the world that will never grow crops, probably never see rain. That's going to force people to move, and it will force people to move all over the world in various directions. So I don't see the issue going away. The cause may be changing, but the issue, I think, is probably going to be with us for an awful long time.
So moving on to something more electoral, obviously Dover District Council turned red in May last year, which is when, you know, as leader of the Labour Group, you became leader of the council. Do you think that's a sign of things to come in Dover at the general election?
I'm going to be obviously honest and say I'm very hopeful that it will be a sign of the times. I think, you know, we targeted the 17 seats that we needed to take control. Plan worked. We were very close to actually winning more than that. I mean, we weren't that far out of taking the seats in River. But yeah, there's a change in the country. I mean, there's a number of councils we're not one going to the polls on the 2nd of May, and I would expect to see very similar results then. You know, the Conservative Party are having real issues. Well, apart from the fact several seem to be wanting to go and join Reform, Reform are saying they're going to stand in every seat because they're the true Conservatives. So, you know, I think Dover is ready for change. I think, personally speaking, the country is ready for change. So, you know, I'm pretty confident, although I am told by others of a difficult political persuasion, he says, looking at a blue board at the moment in my office, that, you know, they're very confident that they'll win at the end of the day. It will be what it will be. But yeah, the feedback we're getting on the street, the canvassing that's being done with residents is very positive. There's a lot of very disillusioned ex-Conservatives out there who have said that they've had enough.
And when you say they've had enough, what have they had enough of?
I think they've had enough generally of the government, of the fact that, you know, and I saw it in the last couple of weeks where, you know, we had this budget, we're going to drop your national insurance by 2%, at which point people have said to us, that's fine, but, you know, one resident quoted to me, 2% to me means very little anyway in real cash terms, but it'll cost me, you know, if it gives me 300 quid, it's going to cost me £1,000 to sort out my suspension on the car because I've gone over a pothole because no one's investing in road infrastructure. You know, it doesn't help if you're wanting to try and find a dentist. It doesn't help if, you know, I think we've recently, in the last 24 hours, a survey on the NHS, it's the lowest satisfaction ratings ever. And these are the things that matter to a lot of the people. Giving a couple of hundred quid is fine, but it doesn't help if you need to use public services, if you're relying on social care, you know, if you're trying to get children into school or the schools are falling down. That, to me, are the real issues that people are talking to me about on the doorstep. You're talking about lack of housing, they can't even get private housing. You know, they're the real issues, which I actually think sometimes, you know, the government forgets about, because they believe offering a reduction in a bit more money in your pocket solves all those problems. Well, it doesn't, unless you want to go to a private dentist, but a couple of hundred quid isn't going to get you a fill-in.
The last thing I wanted to ask you is something more about the council itself and the yep. port. So a few weeks yep. ago, the council under your leadership decided to provide biosecurity checks yep. at the Port of Dover out of its own pocket after DEFRA decided to cut funding. That's, you know, going to cost over 3 million quid over the next couple of years. And a report by Dover District Council's officers said that it places Dover District Council at risk of filing a Section 114 notice, which is essentially, you know, as close to bankrupt as a local council can yep. be. How real yep. is the possibility that Dover District Council might have to file one of those, and what are you going to plan for?
I don't think it's real at all, because what happens is, I mean, to start with, we deal with the biosecurity, we deal with the African swine flu, etc., at the port of entry. So as of, I think it was April, it's all changing so that, you know, importers are supposed to pay monies. Well, all that work that I have to say we believed we were going to get as a port health authority has been moved to Sevington. So Sevington, which I have to say, and I will continue to say, would be an ideal lorry park when we have Brock, Tap and all the chaos we have in Dover, is being used as the Port Health Authority. Well, they will be legislated eventually to be the Port Health Authority, whereas the government invested 23, 26 million building a state-of-the-art facility in Dover, a bastion in Whitfield. Now, although we've allocated 2.6 million from reserves into the budget, it's like anything. Just because it's there doesn't mean to say it's going to be spent on it in that. What we want is to sit down and have meaningful dialogue, because when I spoke to the minister, he said, you're not going to like what I'm going to say, and then led on to it's going to Sevington. But we're so impressed with the work you do on African swine flu that we actually want to increase that, not in just Dover, but we want you to go and club o'clock else in France. Well, my knowledge of sending people to France means for every person you have based in the UK, you probably need about 1.5, 1.6 staff members go to France because of the travelling times, etc. Within about 48 hours of that, DEFRA then announced they're going to cut the funding from about 4 million a year by 2.8 in year one to zero in year two. But we still have responsibility for providing the port with port health officers. We have the responsibility of ensuring that the port doesn't get into the country. Well, you can't do that. And that would mean that the taxpayer would have to pick all of it up, or we literally walk away and, fingers crossed, we never see an African swine flu outbreak in the United Kingdom, because I think it was 15 billion foot, they cost us in foot and mouth. So we've put it in there because, you know, my knowledge of going into negotiations is very rarely do you ever go into a negotiations on a Monday with somebody and it's all sorted out by lunchtime. You know, we need to get in with DEFRA and actually say we have some serious concerns. Now, the EFRA committee, which is a cross-party committee of government that can hold DEFRA to account, have asked some very pertinent questions. And I have to say, we are less than satisfied as a council that actually is being treated very seriously. My experience of dealing with smugglers is sometimes they don't turn up where you tell them to go. So they'll come into Dover and we're saying, go to Sevington. No one's policed it. Some will turn up. Some may get lost. But, you know, African swine flu and the work that's being done, everybody recognises is fundamental to the country. It's not just us. We're not a big pig farming district, but we've got places where throughout the country that could be decimated if this gets into the country. So to tell us we like you to work and we want to expand it, but at the same time we're taking all your funding away from you, which means that if we do it, the district council will have to pick up the entire cost, to us is totally unacceptable. And the actual cost to someone like DEFRA is negligible. It's pence to a department like that, okay, to try and ensure that we are maximising our border security. So I think it was the right decision. I will never argue it's not a right decision, but, you know, that budget was passed in, what, a month ago, something like that, to start. Lots of things can change within a budget.
What about this weekend, Easter?
Well, we've met with the powers that be and the Kent Resilience Task Force to raise our concerns because of, you know, it's yet another holiday and, well, yeah, we're anticipating again problems. But of course, this weekend we've seen that the French have increased their security after that terrible attack in Moscow, and, you know, it's not for us to comment on how a nation tries to secure its borders, and we're not too sure, I have to say at this stage, on the implications that will have on the travelling public. Now, looking out the window currently, it looks nice, but it's probably a bit windy, so it could be a little bit choppy. That may delay some of it. And, you know, as of last night, I wasn't told of what the actual numbers we'd expect an uplift. But I'm also told by the Port of Dover that the French are sending over more staff, all of which should help to keep the traffic moving. But the real issue is that the port, I have to say, struggle with the volume of traffic that's entering the port. And then, you know, it impacts on everything. So Stargate Street, when I was at a meeting with the businesses of Stargate Street, listening to their very legitimate concerns about the impact it has on them, is snarled up. But then so is the rest of Dover. So, you know, Dover just does not move. I've seen ambulances stuck. That's not acceptable. You know, we hear of care workers that can't get to deal with the people that need their support. You know, we have schools that are concerned now. Okay, they've broken up. But schools are saying, you know, if it ever gets bad and it's on a school day, we can't get the teachers in. We can't get some of the pupils can't get in. The bus companies can't operate. We've got hotels that are saying, actually, due to the nature of our beast, we have sort of almost, we have daily deliveries that as required, that we don't stockpile lots of stuff. So if they can't get into us, it causes a major problem. And of course, you know, there's a hotel and there's Bluebirds that both operate weddings and will rely on that sort of income. Well, you know, if I'm going to book my wedding, the last thing I want is there's traffic to get in the way. So it would have a negative effect on businesses because people don't want to either book there or invest. And what we've got to do is make sure Dover is open and tell the public Dover is open for business. So when it's bad, let's be honest and say we have X ambulance delay, but when it's running normally, and I've been there reading social media saying Dover's closed, when I'm sitting in the middle of St. James's going, no, it's not. It's open for business. Getting now, because, you know, everybody needs to carry on their normal day-to-day functions, and that doesn't help when Dover gets congested. So I'm hoping this weekend it improves. I hope this weekend the Kent Resilience Task Force have an officer based in our CCTV, so we communicate in real time between all of the junctions around the whole of the town what the implications are, where we can let them relieve some of the pressures. We'll just have to see, but I think we need another wash up at the end of this weekend, because if what they're putting in place doesn't work, well, it won't work in the summer either, will it?
Yeah. Okay, Kevin Mills, leader of Dover District Council, thank you very much indeed for your time. Okay, that's your lot. Thanks to everyone for joining me on this week's podcast. We'll be back next week when we'll hear from Mike Tapp, Labour's candidate for Dover and Deal at the next election. And don't forget to tune in to KMTV at 5 p.m. each Friday for their politics show. All the best.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.